Greetings, everyone. This is Native Sun, bringing you news of Indian country on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Your reader is Bethany Williams. First today, San Carlos Apache tribe demands investigation into group homes after Emily Pike's murder. This by Sean Dean Silversmith, published on the 28th of March, 2025, at azmirror.com. The San Carlos Apache tribe wants state leaders to launch an investigation and implement stricter regulations for state-licensed residential group homes that serve children, after a tribal teen ran away from a facility in January and was brutally murdered. At the time of her disappearance, Emily Pike, who was 14, lived in a group home in Mesa. The San Carlos tribe's social services department placed her at Sacred Journey, Inc., a residential child care center. "This crime must not go unsolved," San Carlos Apache Chairman Terry Rambler said in a press release. "Emily was murdered in a cruel, depraved, and heinous act, and the perpetrators must be held accountable." Emily ran away from the group home and was last seen on the evening of January 27th near Mesa Drive and McKellops Road, according to the Mesa Police Department. 2 days later, the police issued a poster for Emily labeling her as missing or runaway juvenile. A month after she went missing, the Gila County Sheriff's Office reported that Emily's remains were found on February 14th in a remote area off U.S. Route 60 outside of Globe. It remains an active homicide investigation, and GCSO is collaborating with several agencies, including the San Carlos Apache Tribal Police Department, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. "Our council has offered a $75,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person or persons responsible for Emily's murder," Rambler said. "And the tribe is requesting the public to supplement the reward to generate more interest and leads." The San Carlos Apache Tribal Council sent a letter to Governor Katie Hobbs, Attorney General Chris Mays, and members of the Arizona Legislature requesting an investigation into the group home and calling for legislative reform on the regulations of state-licensed youth group homes. The council cited Emily's death and reports about other children who have run away from the group home in Mesa. The tribe said that Emily is not the first child reported as a runaway from the Sacred Journey, noting that the Mesa Police Department reported about 30 children have run away from the group home over the past 3 years. "What happened to those other children?" Rambler said. "Are they all safe and accounted for? Why has this clear failure to protect these children been allowed to continue unabated for years?" The tribe said, "That's ample reason for the state to require a comprehensive review that goes beyond the ongoing police investigation into Emily's murder." Rambler said the tribe is requesting Hobbs, with her background in social work, to take all steps necessary to implement reforms in group homes across the state that will ensure the safety of children. And the tribe wants Mays to launch an investigation into the circumstances surrounding Emily's unauthorized departure from Sacred Journey. Rambler said the investigation should carefully review the safety, security, monitoring, licensing, and operational standards for group homes, and determine ways to strengthen these to prevent children from leaving their care without permission. "We ask that your recommendations be presented to the legislature to be considered in appropriate legislation that's named in honor of Emily Pike," he said. The council also asked for support on House Bill 2281, which, if passed, will establish a missing Indigenous person alert system. The tribe's request to investigate the Arizona Department of Child Services group home regulations is not the only one brought forward following Emily's death. Senate Health and Human Services Committee Chair Karine Werner is also calling for a probe into the group home regulations. "My heart goes out to those who are grieving the senseless and horrific murder of Emily Pike," she said. "Senate Republicans are currently gathering information on what can be done to prevent future tragedies such as this." Werner said she intends to convene a bipartisan hearing for the Joint Legislative Oversight Committee on the Department of Child Safety, which will include officials from DCS, law enforcement, lawmakers, tribal councils, and their social services departments. She said the goal will be to examine the procedures, protocols, and policies in place to ensure the safety and security of children in these group homes. Arizona's licensed group homes have repeatedly made headlines for egregious mistakes that have cost the lives of children within their care and have threatened the safety of staff, she said. Werner said there may be underlying systemic issues requiring immediate reforms within these government-funded entities, and there should be an opportunity to assess where mistakes are occurring and determine the next steps moving forward. That article was San Carlos Apache Tribe Demands Investigation into Group Homes. On that topic, and also by Shandine Silversmith of the AZ Mirror, but published on April 4th, Arizona hopes to have Missing Endangered Persons Alert System by summer. For years, Indigenous families have shared their experiences of reporting a missing loved one, highlighting how often it is met with a lack of response or urgency from the entities meant to assist them. We do know that there is a huge issue, Captain Paul Etner, tribal liaison for the Arizona Department of Public Safety, said. Etner is Hopi and grew up on the Hopi Nation in northern Arizona. Since 2019, he has worked in ad hoc committees, task forces, and general committees focused on addressing the ongoing crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous peoples. It was very heartbreaking hearing testimonies, he said, of the state and federal hearings held to allow MMIP victims to share their experiences. The blame, he said, belongs across the board: law enforcement, prosecutors, social services, tribal governments, non-tribal communities, and Indian country. The whole system failed, Etner said. It was just heartbreaking that we failed in every single way for the victims and for the victims' families, he added. Finding ways to address and develop solutions for the MMIP crisis within Indian country has been a priority for Indigenous women, leaders, advocates, and communities for years. Part of that work included advocating for the creation of a multi-jurisdictional missing persons alert system, something that is finally about to become a reality as states across the country, including Arizona, work to implement the Federal Communications Commission's new Missing Endangered Person Alert Code. In March, Governor Katie Hobbs met with several key stakeholders, including the Arizona Department of Public Safety, and representatives from tribal nations to develop a plan for implementing the new alert code by summer. I know that so many families have been affected by this crisis and have fought for years, Hobbs told the Arizona Mirror, adding that she hopes that with the implementation of the MEP alert, these families will finally feel a sense of justice. Hobbs said that when an Indigenous person goes missing, a lot of times their case does not rise to the level of getting an amber, silver, or blue alert, and the goal of the MEP alert is to fill in that gap. As governor, I see my role as elevating those voices and making sure we're taking action on the issues that matter most to communities across the state, Hobbs said. And this is just one example of that. The governor said that implementing the FCC's new MEP alert in Arizona was prioritized based on the recommendation from the MMIP task force, and seeing it come to fruition is great and validates the task force's work. The MEP alert code will be used for missing and endangered persons who do not meet the amber or silver alert criteria, according to the FCC, enabling a more rapid and coordinated response to these incidents. The FCC adopted the new alert code in 2024, stating it will be especially beneficial to tribal communities where Indigenous peoples face a disproportionate risk of going missing, experiencing violence, and murder. There's still no single database that provides accurate numbers or data related to missing and murdered Indigenous peoples across the country, with no centralized database among the thousands of federal, state, and tribal entities. The information available is limited. Jason Chavez, who leads Hobbs's Office on Tribal Relations, said there's been positive feedback from tribal leaders and tribal law enforcement regarding the implementation of the MEP alert. Chavez said that tribal leaders and communities have long called for this type of alert, and the MMIP task force has advocated for it. According to the FCC, the MEP alert is part of the nation's emergency alert system and wireless emergency alert system. It will be part of a set of codes utilized by tribal, state, and local law enforcement agencies with access to the system, delivering a critical alert message to the public through television, radio, and wireless phones. The Arizona Department of Public Safety will utilize the IPAWS alerting system for MEP alerts. The system can send alerts to specific locations as narrow as cross streets where the person went missing or as broad as the state. The U.S. Department of Justice will release guidelines on pushing out MEP alerts, but they have not yet been released. Captain Thomas Neve with the Arizona Department of Public Safety Emergency Management District, who oversees the operations of Arizona's alert system, said they're preparing to fully establish the alert for Arizona, so they're ready when the guidelines are released. Neve said it's important to have clear guidelines for what constitutes an MEP alert because there's potential for overloading the public with alerts that it desensitizes the general public to the point they ignore the alerts. All Arizona tribes can make an MEP alert request, and Neve said they would work closely with any tribal agencies. It doesn't matter if the tribal person went missing on or off the reservation. We can do an activation for that person, he said. Etnier said the MEP alert system is not the tool that will end the crisis of MMIP, and it should not be viewed as such. It's not just incumbent upon local law enforcement to utilize, he said. We have to work together as a whole. Navajo Nation Council Delegate Amber Canazba-Crotty said she hopes that as Arizona works through implementing the MEP alert, there will be a clear idea of how the multiple agencies can work together to push the alert. That was Arizona hopes to have missing endangered persons alert system by summer. You're listening to Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds of Arizona has been bringing the disabled audio access to print information for over 45 years. Learn more about how you can support us at our website, sunsounds.org, where you can also listen to our live streams or find individual episodes on demand. You can now also listen to us on our dedicated app that you can use on both Apple and Android devices. This next piece is from Cronkite News. Online cooking show and lifestyle blog encourage indigenous ingredients in everyday meals by Anna Eric, published on the 3rd of April, 2025. Since she was 3 years old, Mariah Gladstone says she has had a passion for food. After graduating from high school in Northwest Montana, she studied environmental engineering at Columbia University in New York. During summers, she returned to her Blackfeet Nation home, where she realized how disconnected indigenous communities were from their traditional food systems. After I graduated college, I would take vacation days from my real-world job to go to food sovereignty conferences, said Gladstone, who's Blackfeet and Cherokee. At one of those conferences, I said, someone really needs to start a cooking show about indigenous foods. I think I'm going to do that. IndigiKitchen was born. The online cooking show is a combination of content on YouTube as well as recipes shared on its website. The foods contain native ingredients like berries, corn, squash, and wild rice. Food sovereignty is a concept coined in 1996 by La Via Campesina, a global movement of farmers that recognizes the right of people to healthy and culturally appropriate food produced through ecologically sound and sustainable methods. On her website, Gladstone emphasizes the importance of the recipes for indigenous people. I want to connect people with information about sustainable harvesting methods, planting knowledge, sustainable hunting, and of course the recipes and the food that are ways of using our ancestral knowledge in our modern lives, she said. Gladstone spreads this knowledge by working with native farmers and fishermen in the hopes that it not only restores their businesses, but the land management and traditional ecologies. While based in Montana, Indigikishen has made its way across the country. Gladstone is a popular speaker with groups in the Southwest and the Great Lakes region who hire her for educational lectures, cooking classes, and school residencies. Gladstone also has ties to Canada, where she has formed relationships with other nations in the Blackfoot Confederacy. These connections have motivated Gladstone to continue her work with Indigikitchen, and she said she's grateful to use a tool like social media in order to reach the right audiences. Indian country is small, and Facebook is a digital telegraph, so it has a way of reaching a lot of communities very quickly, where everyone shares my recipes and utilizes them, she said. The more people I see using those recipes, the bigger difference it makes to support native producers as well as healthy nutrition in our communities. Among the recipes on her website are Three Sisters Soup, which uses corned beans and squash, pemmican, a mixture of dried buffalo meat, dried cranberries and blueberries, and grass-fed beef tallow, sunflower maple cookies, and mesquite blue cornbread. Connecting Indigenous people with the food they ate before European foods were introduced into their diets is a movement gaining popularity. According to the National Indian Council on Aging, Native foods included seeds, nuts, corn, beans, chili, squash, wild fruits and greens, herbs, fish, and game. People like Gladstone call these pre-contact foods, and they emphasize the importance for Indigenous people to celebrate their food culture and improve their health by returning to a more traditional diet. That's especially important for the Navajo Nation, which the USDA classifies as a food desert. There are only 14 grocery stores for a landmass of 29,000 square miles, forcing people to travel a long way to buy nutritious foods. Another native food and lifestyle blogger who promotes Diné, or Navajo, recipes is Elena Yazzi. On her website, thefancynavajo.com, she posts recipes for blue corn waffles, sumac berry smoothies, and blue corn oatmeal from her cookbook, The Modern Navajo Kitchen. On her Instagram, which has 29,000 followers, she encourages others to embrace their indigenous culture through recipes, fashion, and gardening. She started her website in 2014 with the goal of showing easy ways to blend indigenous ingredients into everyday dishes. There's a bit of art to it because you can't just throw things in without knowing the food science around it, but it's not too difficult, she said. Yazzi, who was born in New Mexico, said she previously stocked up on ingredients like blue corn when she went home to Navajo land. She lives in Phoenix now and finds it easier to buy items online because of the growing number of native small businesses that offer local ingredients. Since her cookbook was published in October of 2024, Yazzi has stayed busy with cooking events and demonstrations. "That's really my passion," she said. "I want people to implement these recipes into their daily life so that we can continue our traditions." In September, Indigikitchen's Gladstone will be speaking at the Flagstaff Festival of Science at the invitation of Kelly Saguenay, who is Diné, Navajo, and a festival board member. Gladstone will talk about Indigenous ecological stewardship, the cultural significance of Native foods, and bridging Indigenous and Western science. Saguenay said she found Gladstone through the Native American Food Sovereignty Alliance's Instagram account and believed it would be beneficial to have a member of the Indigenous community with a science background be a featured speaker at the 10-day festival. "Since our community in Flagstaff has a high Native American population, I just want the little kids out there to be able to see a scientist with a Native background. And I think it's also cool that if you go for a degree in the STEM field, you don't have to work for a big corporation. You can do what Mariah did with Indigikitchen and start your own project," she said. The Flagstaff Festival of Science begins September 19th, and Gladstone will be the first Indigenous keynote speaker that evening. I'll have to remember to put that on my calendar. That article was Online Cooking Show and Lifestyle Blog Encourages Indigenous Ingredients. Speaking of Indigenous ingredients, In a win for tribes, Forest Service halts commercial huckleberry picking. This was originally published by High Country News. I'm reading it reprinted at ICT's website. It's by Josephine Woolington and was published at ICT on April 7th, 2025. The U.S. Forest Service announced Monday it will temporarily prohibit commercial picking of huckleberries this summer in Grifford Pinchot National Forest in southwestern Washington. Commercially picked berries have fueled an entire huckleberry industry, flavoring ice cream, sodas, pies, jams, vodkas, and more, at the expense of Yakima Nation tribal members, as detailed in High Country News' March feature. Huckleberries are a vital culture and ecological resource, and we must ensure their sustainability for generations to come, Johanna Kovarik, Gifford Pinchot Forest supervisor, said in a written statement. This change allows us to work more closely with tribal governments and local stakeholders and law enforcement to improve management while reducing conflicts. The announcement comes after years of complaints from members from the Kamilpa Band of the Yakima Nation about the agency's commercial program. Gifford Pinchot is the only national forest that allows large-scale commercial harvest of huckleberries, which are a traditional food for the Yakima Nation and other Pacific Northwest indigenous peoples. Members of the Yakima Nation have reserved rights under their 1855 treaty with the U.S. government to harvest huckleberries in Gifford Pinchot National Forest. "Our elders, I think, are smiling about this," said Trina Sherwood, a 60-year-old Kamilpa member and food gatherer. "It's like a dream come true," said Elaine Harvey, who's 48, and who is Sherwood's niece and a food gatherer from the Kamilpa Band. Harvey and others in her family have pushed the Forest Service to ban commercial picking for years, which she said has infringed on tribal members' treaty rights to harvest. Both Harvey and Sherwood hope that the Forest Service will permanently prohibit commercial harvesting. Federal officials will conduct an assessment and consult with tribes this year before making any long-term changes to the commercial program. Forest Service officials were not immediately available for an interview. Most commercial pickers descend from Vietnamese and Cambodian families who came to the U.S. in the 1970s and found work picking huckleberries for low wages. Pickers sell berries directly to individual commercial huckleberry buyers, who are often small business owners or contractors for wild food companies like Mikuni Wild Harvest, a Canadian corporation, with a distribution center in Tacoma. Those companies then sell to private customers, chefs, wineries, and other companies that create huckleberry products. Tillamook Creamery, according to a Forest Service official, buys berries harvested from Gifford Pinchot for the company's huckleberry ice cream. In its press release, the Forest Service said that commercial pickers take 50 to 70,000 gallons of berries from the forest each year. Huckleberries grow only in the mountains and have resisted Western scientists' decades-long attempts to cultivate their genes to grow them on farms. That's why the berries fetch a high price, up to $200 a gallon. Commercial pickers pay either $60 for a two-week permit with a 40-gallon limit or $105 for a season permit with a 70-gallon limit. Gifford Pinchot sold 928 permits last season, totaling over $83,000 in revenue. During annual meetings with Forest Service officials, Harvey and other Yakima Nation leaders have said that commercial pickers leave few berries for tribal members. They threaten elders, who are mostly women, by blocking roads, picking closely off the same bush, and bringing dogs to the fields. Some also damage the shrubs using illegal rakes to quickly strip berries from the bushes. Tribal members have observed commercial pickers harvesting berries before the commercial season begins in mid-August and encroaching on areas reserved for exclusive tribal harvest. In the past, Sherwood could harvest 4 to 6 gallons of berries per day, but with the increase in commercial pickers, she's lucky if she can pick 1.5 gallons for herself. It has just really changed the landscape with all this commercial picking, she said. I go back to places where I used to see berries in abundance, and it's all just taken away. The Forest Service cited sustainability concerns, enforcement challenges, and escalating conflicts among harvesters as reasons for not issuing commercial permits this season, but did not specifically mention the program's impact on Yakima Nation members' treaty rights to gather. Drought, habitat loss, and invasive species such as the spotted-winged Drosophila, a small fruit fly whose larvae have been found inside huckleberries, are also among the agency's cited concerns. Harvey and Sherwood want to see more Forest Service officers within the fields this summer to enforce the ban and protect tribal pickers who may face intimidation or harassment from those who oppose the temporary commercial closure. But the Forest Service has struggled to adequately patrol the fields for years, citing a lack of funding. And as the Trump administration has slashed the federal workforce, including Forest Service employees, Harvey worries that the agency won't be able to increase patrols. Hopefully people will be safe this summer, she said. Sherwood is proud of the efforts over the years by her family, including her niece Elaine Harvey, to advocate for the protection of huckleberries. It's always been instilled in us, by our elders, our mothers, our grandmothers, Sherwood said, as speaking up for traditional foods. We're very protective of our resources. The Kamilpa Band has a long history of defending their treaty rights to gather huckleberries and other traditional foods that have been threatened by Forest Service mismanagement. Kamilpa Chief Atway William Yollop established what's known as the Handshake Agreement in 1932, which reserved part of the berry fields in Gifford Pinchot for exclusive tribal harvest. Nearly 50 years later, Sherwood's family pushed the Forest Service in the 1980s to allow the Kamilpa Band to reestablish a traditional huckleberry feast in the fields to commence berry season, in late July or early August. Her brother and Kamilpa chief, Atway Fred Ike Sr., worked with Cielo chief Atway Howard Jim, along with elders including Sherwood's parents, Moses Dick Sr., and Elsie Billy Dick, to host an annual feast. We wanted to revitalize that history and recognize it and make sure our presence was known, Sherwood said. She now helps organize the feast with Harvey and other family members, gathering berries and enough food to feed the longhouse for a few days. Her grandmother, Atway Susie Walsey Billy, lived for weeks at Sawtooth Mountain in Gifford Pinchot during huckleberry season. They'd stay there until it snowed, Sherwood said. I think about that a lot, and that's what pushed me forward. That was Forest Service Halts Commercial Huckleberry Picking. You've been listening to Native Sun, the show for Indigenous issues on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Your reader is Bethany Williams.